the size of a ballroom, with pillars of dark cherry wood and tasseled red lanterns hanging from the ceiling. Even on a Thursday morning it was noisy and bustling. Waitresses in smocks pushed carts up and down the aisles while bow-tied waiters hurried from table to table, checks and pots of tea in hand. They sat by a window overlooking Jackson Street, the sight of Asian crowds comforting to Liam. As the train of carts rolled by, Marcus picked and rejected expertly from the offerings, ordering in Cantonese and explaining in English as the varieties of dim sum were heaped before them in a daunting display, including shumai, dumplings of minced pork and scallions, long-stemmed Chinese broccoli and sliced roasted pork with candied skin the color of watermelon seeds. "Parrish won't touch those," Marcus said approvingly as he watched Liam suck the dimpled skin off a chicken's foot, leaving only the twiggy bones. After the waiter swept away the dishes, they sat quietly with a tin pot of chrysanthemum tea between them. Liam rolled the bottom of his teacup in a circle around a grease stain on the tablecloth before he asked Marcus about his family, something Marcus had never discussed in front of him. All Liam knew about Marcus was that he'd lived in Hong Kong until he was 18, that he was enrolled in business administration at San Francisco State but hardly ever went there, and that he worked out at the gym every day. His father, Marcus said with a snort, was an executive at a rubber company who had sent him to study overseas, expecting he would eventually return to help run the business. But 3 years ago, a spiteful ex-lover had mailed his father one of Marcus's love letters, with candid pictures tucked into the folds. "Very candid pictures," Marcus said darkly. After that, his father had disowned him, and now Parrish paid his expenses. "Can you imagine anything worse?" Marcus concluded. Liam wasn't sure whether Marcus was referring to the lover's betrayal, the father's plans, or Parrish's money. What he really wanted to know was what candid meant. But when Marcus only sipped his tea, not seeming to expect an answer, Liam spoke instead about his own family, all farmers, hawkers, and draftees. Nobody had ever traveled very far from Lang Suyen unless he was drafted by the army. Liam was the family's first explorer, and perhaps that was the reason his parents were so anxious at the bus station Lang Suyen, one of the few moments of his past he recalled with any clarity. The patch of unshaded dirt and cement was crowded with passengers ready to board, holding cartons tied with twine and keeping close watch on their pigs and chickens, shuffling in wire cages. As the heat rose in waves, the odor of human sweat and animal dung, thickened by the dust, rose with it. "We raised you well," his father said, unable to look him in the eye with his own bluish-gray ones, hazy from cataracts. "I know you won't lose yourself in the city." "I won't," Liam promised. "You can depend on me." He heard the driver shouting for passengers to board as his mother ran her hands up and down his arms and patted his chest, as if frisking him, before she squeezed a small wad of bills into his pocket. "Take care of yourself," she said. Around her mouth, deep wrinkles appeared to be stitches, sewing her lips together. "I won't be able to anymore." He hadn't said he loved her, or his father, before he left. He'd been too distracted by his desperation to get on the bus, for without a seat, he'd have to stand shoulder to shoulder in the aisle, or else risk his life riding on the roof all the way to Saigon. "Well, how could you know that was going to happen?" Marcus leaned forward. "You're not a fortune teller. Anyway, that's all in the past. You can't dwell on it. The best way to help them now is to help yourself." "Yeah," he said, even though this was, to him, a very American way of thinking. "The point is, what do you want to be?" "To be? In the future. What do you want to do with yourself?" No one had ever asked Liam such a question, and Liam rarely asked it of himself. He was content with his job at the liquor store, especially when he compared his fate to that of his friends back home. The underage ones, like him, had become bar sweeps or houseboys for the Americans, while older, luckier ones dodged army service, becoming thieves or pimps or rich men's servants. Unlucky ones got drafted, and very unlucky ones did not come home at all, or if they did, returned as beggars who laid their stumps on the side of the road. Marcus was watching him expectantly. The idea of saying he wanted to be a doctor or a lawyer or a policeman was utterly ludicrous, but the desire to appear noble in Marcus's eyes, and maybe his own, seized him. "I want to be good," he said at last. "Well," Marcus glanced at the bill, "don't we all?" The next day at the liquor store, Liam counted seconds by sweeps of his broom and rings of the register, his shift threatening never to end when only yesterday he'd hoped the day would run on forever. After he'd grabbed the check from Marcus and paid for the dim sum, they had browsed the curio shops of Chinatown together, then driven to Treasure Island to see the Golden Gate Bridge, winding up by dusk in a Market Street theater where they sat knee to knee watching One flew over the cuckoo's nest. Later, eating sushi at a Japanese restaurant on Sutter in Japantown, neither mentioned the contact, talking instead about Jack Nicholson, whose films Liam had never seen, and Western Europe, which Liam had never visited, and the varieties of sushi, which Liam had never eaten before. In short, Marcus did most of the talking, and that was fine with Liam. Talking with Marcus was easy, because all Liam had to do was ask questions. Marcus, however, rarely asked him anything. And during those moments when Liam ran out of inquiries, silence ensued, and the hum of the car or the chatter of the other diners became uncomfortably noticeable. Neither spoke of Parrish, not even when they returned to the Victorian and Marcus opened one of Parrish's bottles of red wine, a Napa Valley Pinot Noir. Never having drunk wine before, Liam woke up the next morning feeling as if the corkscrew had been driven into his forehead. He could barely crawl out of bed into the bathroom, where, as he brushed his teeth, he vaguely remembered Marcus helping him up the stairs and easing him into bed. Seeing no sign of him before he went to work, he concluded Marcus was sleeping in. When he returned to the Victorian in the evening, he found Marcus watching television in the living room, clad in his bathrobe and with his hair mussed. "A letter came for you today," Marcus said, switching off the television with the remote control. On the coffee table was a battered blue airmail marked by an unmistakable handwriting, the pen marks so forceful they almost cut through the thin envelope. Liam's father had replied to his first note, the airmail addressed to him at Camp Pendleton and forwarded by the resettlement agency in San Diego. "Aren't you going to open it?" Marcus said. "No," he muttered. "I don't think so." He rubbed the envelope between his fingers, unable to explain how he dreaded the letter's arrival as much as he yearned for it. Once he opened the letter, his life would change again, and perhaps he wanted it to stay the same. Summoning all his will, he laid the airmail on the coffee table again and sat down next to Marcus on the couch, where together they stared at the blue envelope as if it were an anonymous letter slipped under an adulterer's door. "They think we've got a Western disease," Marcus said, "or so my father says." "We?" Liam said. "Don't think I don't know." Liam kept his eyes on the letter, certain his father had written no more than what needed to be said. "Make money and send it home. Take care and be good." The message would be underlined once, and then once more, leaving him to guess at anything too dangerous to be said in his father's bare vocabulary. But whereas his father had never sought to find new words, Liam was the opposite. He looked up at Marcus and asked the question he'd wanted to since yesterday. "What does candid mean?"
"Candid?" Marcus said. "Yeah, right. Candid. It means being caught by surprise, like in a photograph or a film, when someone takes your picture and you're not looking. Or it means someone who's frank, who's honest and direct."
Liam took a deep breath. "I want to be candid. I'd like to be candid."
"Shut up," Liam said, putting his hand on Marcus's knee.
Afterward, he sensed things might not have gone well. First, none of their clothes came off as smoothly as he expected, because all of a sudden the buttons and zippers were smaller than he knew them to be, and his fingers larger and clumsier. His rhythm seemed to be off, too. Sometimes in his eagerness he moved too fast, and to make up for it, or because he was embarrassed, he then went too slow, throwing them out of sync and causing him to apologize repeatedly for an elbow here or a knee there, until Marcus said, "Stop saying you're sorry and just enjoy yourself for heaven's sake." So he did his best to relax and give himself up to the experience. Later, his arm thrown over Marcus's body, facing his back, Liam wasn't surprised to discover how little he remembered. His habit of forgetting was too deeply ingrained, as if he passed his life perpetually walking backward through a desert, sweeping away his footprints, leaving him with only scattered recollections of rough lips pressed against his and the comfort of a man's muscular weight. "I love you," he said. Marcus did not roll over or look behind him, did not say, "I love you," in return, and indeed, said nothing at all. The ticking of Parrish's antique grandfather clock grew louder and louder with each second, and by the time the patter of rain on the roof was distinct, Liam was fumbling awkwardly with his underwear.
"Can you just wait a minute?" Marcus said, turning around and hooking one leg over Liam's body. "Don't you think you're overreacting?"
"No," Liam said, trying to unpry without success Marcus's leg, honed by countless hours on the treadmill and the squat machine. "I need to go to the bathroom. Please."
"You just got caught by surprise. Sooner or later, you'll figure out love's just a reflex action some of us have. Marcus stroked Liam's hand. A week from now, you're not even going to know why you told me that.
Okay, he said, not sure whether he wanted to believe Marcus or not.
Sure.
You know what else is in your future?
Do not... don't... tell me.
A year from now, you'll be the one hearing other men say they love you, Marcus said. They'll say you're too pretty to be alone.
Marcus pulled him closer, and, as the rain continued to fall, they held each other. Outside, a car began honking repeatedly, a sound Liam knew by now to mean that someone, double-parked, was blocking the narrow street in front of the house. Then all was quiet but for the clock, and he thought Marcus might have dozed off until he stirred and said, "Aren't you going to read the letter?" He'd forgotten about the airmail, but now that Marcus had mentioned it, he felt it glowing in the darkened living room, bearing on its blue face the oil of his father's touch, and perhaps his mother's, too. Airmail, the only thing he owned that truly mattered.
"I never read it to you.
I will never read it to you. That's the future tense.
I'll never read you the letter."
"Now you're being petty.
Don't read it to me, then."
"But I will tell you what I'll write."
"Only if you want to," Marcus said, yawning.
Until this moment, Liam hadn't thought about what he would write to his father and mother once their letter had arrived. So he improvised, beginning with how the tone would be as important as the content. His letter, he said, would be a report from an exotic city, one with a Spanish name, famous for cable cars, Alcatraz Island, and the Golden Gate Bridge. He would include postcards of the tourist sites, and he'd mention how funny it was to live in a city where people who weren't even Asian knew about the Autumn Festival. When enormous crowds in Chinatown celebrated the Lunar New Year, he'd be there, throwing down firecrackers at the feet of a dancing lion, hoping his family was doing the same. The crunch of burnt firecrackers under his feet would remind him of his boyhood at home, and the letter he'd write would remind him of times when the family gathered around his father as he read, aloud, the occasional note from a distant relative. At the end, Liam would tell them not to worry about him, because, he'd write, "I'm working hard to save money. I'm even making friends, and we live in a mauve house." He heard the steady rise and fall of Marcus's breathing, and afraid Marcus was fading into sleep, he couldn't stop himself from asking the other question he'd wanted to ask since the previous day. "Tell me something," he said. Marcus's eyes fluttered and opened. "Am I good?" A light drizzle tapped against the windows, the sound of Friday night on a rainy day. "Yes," Marcus said, closing his eyes once more. "You were very good." This much, at least, he could write home about. After Marcus fell asleep, Liam slid out of bed and went to the bathroom, where he stood under a spray of hot water for so long he nearly fainted from the heat and steam. He had his pants on and was combing his hair when the phone rang in the living room.
"I just wanted to see how you two were doing,"
Parrish said, loud and cheerful, as if he'd been out drinking. "Just fine," Liam said, eyeing the letter on the coffee table. "Nothing special." He didn't like speaking on the phone, where body language was no help in making himself understood, and he kept the conversation short. Parrish didn't seem to mind, and said good night just as boisterously as he'd said hello. Liam sat down on the couch and opened the letter carefully. When he unfolded the single sheet of onion-skin paper, translucent in the light, he recognized once again his father's script, awkward and loopy, as hard for him to decipher as it was for his father to write. September 20th, 1975. "Dear son, we got your airmail yesterday. Everyone's so happy to know you're alive and well. We're all fine. This summer, your uncles and cousins were re-educated with the other enlisted puppet soldiers. The party forgave their crimes. Your uncles were so grateful. They donated their houses to the revolution. Our lives are more joyful now that your uncles, your cousins, and their wives and children are living with us in our house. The cadres tell us that we will erase the past and rebuild our glorious country. When you have time, send us the news from America. It must be more sinful even than Saigon. So remember what the cadres say. The revolutionary man must live a civil, healthy, correct life. We all think of you often. Your mother misses you and sends you her love. So do I. Your father." After he read the letter a second time, he folded it, slid it back into its envelope, and let it lie inert on the coffee table. Restless, he stood up and walked over to the bay window overlooking the street and the sidewalks
empty this late in the evening. The light in the room had turned the window into a mirror, superimposing his likeness over the landscape outside. When he raised his hand, his reflection raised its hand, and when he touched his face, the reflection did the same, and when he traced the curve of his cheek and the line of his jaw, so too did the mirror image. Why, then, did he not recognize himself? And why did he see right through himself to the dark street outside? Raindrops on the glass dappled the reflection of his face. He waited at the streaky window for several minutes until he saw a sign of life. Two men striding quickly down the street, shoulders occasionally brushing and hands deep in the pockets of their jackets. Their heads, ducked down low against the drizzle, were bent toward each other at a slight angle as they listened to what the other was saying. At one time he would have thought the two men could only be friends. Now he saw they could easily be lovers. As they passed under a street lamp, one of them said something that made the other laugh, his head tilting back so that his unremarkable face was illuminated for a second. The man's eyes turned to Liam at that instant, and Liam, realizing he was quite visible from the street, wondered what kind of figure he must have cut, bare-chested and arms akimbo, his hair slicked back. Suddenly the man raised his hand, as if to say hello. When his partner looked toward the window as well, Liam waved in return, and for a moment there was only the three of them, sharing a fleeting connection. Then the men passed by, and long after they had vanished into the shadows he was still standing with his hand pressed to the window, wondering if someone, behind blinds and curtains, might be watching. War Years. Before Mrs. Hua broke into our lives in the summer of 1983, nothing my mother did surprised me. Her routine was as predictable as the rotation of the earth, beginning with how she rapped on my door every morning, at 6, 6:15, and 6:30, until at last I was awake. When I emerged from my bedroom, she was already dressed, invariably wearing a short-sleeved blouse and skirt of matching pastels. She owned 7 such outfits, and if she had on fuchsia, I knew it was Monday. Before we departed, she switched off the lights, checked the burners, tugged on the black iron grills guarding our windows, always in that order, and then, in the car, ordered me to lock my door. As my father steered the Oldsmobile and I sat in the back reading a comic book, my mother worked on her makeup. By the time we arrived at St. Patrick 10 minutes later, she was finished, the flags of blush on her cheeks blending in with her foundation. Perfume was the last touch, a pump of the spray on either side of her neck. The dizzying scent of gardenias clung to me in Ms. Corman's summer school classroom, where, for 7 hours every day, I spoke only English. I liked school, even summer school. It was like being on vacation from home, and at 3 o'clock, I was always a little disappointed to walk the 4 blocks to the grocery store my parents owned, the New Saigon Market, where English was hardly ever spoken, and Vietnamese was loud. My mother and father rarely left their posts, the cash registers flanking the entrance of the New Saigon. Customers always crowded the market, one of the few places in San Jose where the Vietnamese could buy the staples and spices of home, jasmine rice and star anise, fish sauce and fire engine red chilies. People haggled endlessly with my mother over everything, beginning with the rock sugar, which I pretended was yellow kryptonite, and ending with the varieties of meat in the freezer, from pork chops and catfish with a glint of light in their eyes to shoestrings of chewy tripe and packets of chicken hearts, small and tender as button mushrooms. "Can't we just sell TV dinners?" I asked once. It was easy to say TV dinners in Vietnamese, since the word for television was TV, but there were no Vietnamese words for other things I wanted. "And what about bologna?" "What?" My mother's brow furrowed. "If I can't pronounce it, my customers won't buy it. Now go stamp the prices on those cans. They're just going to ask for a lower price." I was 13, beginning to be brave enough to say what I had suspected for a while, that my mother wasn't always right. "Why do they haggle over everything? Why can't they just pay the price that's there?" "Are you going to be the kind of person who always pays the asking price?" my mother demanded, "or the kind who fights to find out what something's really worth?" I wasn't sure. All I knew was that in the New Saigon, my chore every afternoon was to price the cans and packages. I was on my knees, rummaging for the stamp pad on the shelf behind my mother, when Mrs. Hua introduced herself. Like my mother, she was in her late 40s and dressed in monochrome, a white jacket, white pants, and white shoes, with bug-eyed sunglasses obscuring her face. As my mother bagged her purchases, Mrs. Hua said, "I'm collecting funds for the fight against the communists, my dear." I knew the basics of our history as well as I knew the story of Adam and Eve. The communists had marched from North Vietnam in 1975 to invade South Vietnam, driving us out all the way across the Pacific to California. I had no memories of the war, but Mrs. Hua said others had not forgotten. A guerrilla army of former South Vietnamese soldiers was training in the jungles of Thailand, preparing to launch a counterattack in unified Vietnam. The plan was to stir the unhappy people against their communist rulers, incite a revolution, and resurrect the Republic of the South. "Our men need our support," Mrs. Hua said, "and we need good citizens like yourself to contribute." My mother rubbed one ankle against the other, her nylon scratching. A seam had opened behind her knee, but my mother would keep wearing the same hose until the run nipped at her heels. "I wish I could help, Mrs. Hua, but times are hard," my mother said. "Our customers are cutting back on everything, what with the recession and the gas prices. And our daughter's in college. Her tuition is like a down payment on a house every year." "I struggle making ends meet, too." Mrs. Hua unclasped and clasped the silver latch on her purse. A thin gold band encircled her ring finger, and the red enamel on her nails was as polished and glossy as a new car's paint. "But people talk. Did you hear about Mrs. Bin? People say she's a communist sympathizer and all because she's too cheap to give anything. There's even talk of boycotting her store." My mother knew Mrs. Bin, owner of the Liz and Me Beauty Salon a few blocks further west downtown, but my mother changed the topic to the steamy June weather and the price of gold. Mrs. Hua agreed about the temperature, smiling and displaying a formidable wall of teeth. She glanced at me before leaving my mother with this. "Think about it, dear. Taking back our homeland is a noble cause for which we should all be proud to fight." "Idiot," my mother muttered after Mrs. Hua was gone. As we drove home that evening along 10th Street, my mother recounted the episode to my father, who had been too busy at his own register to overhear the conversation. When she mentioned the guerrillas, I imagined them to be unshaven, mosquito-bitten men with matted hair, wearing ragged tiger-stripe fatigues, living on rainwater, wild boar, and aphids, practicing hand-to-hand combat skills by bayoneting jackfruit. From the back seat, I said, "How much are you giving Mrs. Hua?" "Nothing," she replied. "It's extortion." "But they're fighting the communists," I said. "Also known as Chinese and North Koreans, with Cubans and Sandinistas threatening infiltration and invasion from south of our border, as President Reagan explained in World News Tonight. Shouldn't we help them?" "Oh, the war's over." My mother sounded tired. "There's no fighting it again." I was outraged, for Mrs. Hua's appearance proved the war was not over, and that she had somehow followed us from the old Saigon to the new one. What was more, I had read Newsweek in the dentist's office and knew we were in the midst of an epic battle against the evil empire of the Soviet Union. But if I was unhappy with my mother's response, I was even more upset with my father's. "Well, the war may be over," he said, wiggling his little finger in his ear, "but paying a little hush money would make our lives a lot easier." My mother said nothing, merely drumming her fingers on the armrest. I knew she would have her way with my father, a bald man with the deliberate moves and patient eyes of a turtle. Late that night, hurrying from the kitchen to my room with a glass of water, I heard my mother working to persuade him behind their closed door. There was no time to eavesdrop. We had recently read The Fall of the House of Usher in Ms. Corman's class, and the fear of seeing someone undead in the dark hallway made me rush past their door. Just as my mother said, "I've dealt with worse than her." Dread was stronger than curiosity. I shut my door and jumped into bed shivering, pushing aside my summer textbooks, which were wrapped in brown covers I had cut from a shopping bag and upon which I had scrawled math and American history. Perhaps my mother was talking about the famine at the end of the Second World War when she was 9. Last year, an evening television report on the Ethiopian famine had prompted my mother to mention this other famine while I plucked the gray hairs from her head. "Do you know a dozen children in my village starved to death?" she said, even though I obviously did not know.
Older people, too. Sometimes, right on the street. One day, I found a girl I used to play with, dead, on her doorstep. My mother lapsed into silence as she stared at a point on the wall above the television, and I did not say anything. It was the kind of story she told all the time, and in any case, I was too distracted to ask questions. She was paying me for every strand I found, and I was intent on my search, each gray hair bringing me one nickel closer to the next issue of Captain America. In the days and nights that passed, my mother never brought up Mrs. Hua, but the woman had unsettled her. My mother began talking during our evening bookkeeping, a time when she was usually completely focused on calculating the daily receipts. We worked at the dining table, counting cash, rolling coins into paper packages the size of firecrackers, and stamping the New Saigon's address onto the back of the personal checks, the Monopoly Money food stamps, and the yellow coupons from aid to families with dependent children. When I added the sums with a humming mechanical calculator bigger than our rotary telephone, I never needed to look at the keypad. I knew every number's place by heart. It would be the only time I was ever good at math. As we did the day's reckoning, my mother reported on the rumors of former South Vietnamese soldiers organizing not only a guerrilla army in Thailand, but also a secret front here in the United States, its purpose to overthrow the communists. Grimmer than rumors was how unknown assailants had firebombed a Vietnamese newspaper editor's office in Garden Grove. He died, while another editor had been shot to death, along with his wife, in the doorway of their house in Virginia. The murderers were never caught. They just said in public what a lot of people already say in private, my mother said, wetting her fingers on a sponge. Making peace with the communists might not be such a bad thing. I wrote down figures in a ledger, never looking up. My father and I worked in t-shirts and shorts, but my mother wore only a nightgown of sheer green fabric without a bra. She wasn't aware of how her breasts swayed like anemones under shallow water, embarrassing me whenever I saw those dark and doleful areolas with their nipples as thick as my index finger. My mother's breasts were nothing like those of the girls in my class, or so I imagined in fantasies that had been confirmed the week before when I'd seen Emmy Suchita's nipple through the gap between two buttons of her shirt, pink and pert, exactly like the eraser on the pencil in my hand. Without raising my gaze from the ledger, I said, "But you always tell me the communists are bad people."
"Oh-ho-ho," my father said with a chortle. "So you do pay attention. Sometimes I can't tell what's going on behind those thick glasses of yours."
"The communists are evil," my mother riffled through a stack of $20 bills. She had never finished grade school, her father forcing her to stay at home to care for her siblings, and yet she could count money by hand and add figures in her head more quickly than I could on the calculator. "There's no doubt about it. They don't believe in God, and they don't believe in money."
"Oh, but they believe in taking other people's money," my father said.
He spoke often of his auto parts store, which, according to his brothers, no longer had any parts to sell under communist ownership. We had lived above the store, and sometimes I wondered if a communist child was sleeping in my bed, and if so, what kind of books a red read, and what kind of movies he saw. Captain America was out of the question, but he must have seen Luke Skywalker crossing lightsabers with Darth Vader. I had seen Star Wars a dozen times on videotape, and if anyone was so deprived as to have not watched it even once, then the country in which he lived surely needed a revolution. But my mother would not have agreed. She wrapped a paper band around the 20s and said, "I hate the communists as much as Mrs. Hua, but she's fighting a war that can't be won. I'm not throwing away my money on a lost cause." My father ended the conversation by standing and sweeping the cash, coins, checks, and food stamps into the vinyl satchel he carried every morning to the Bank of America. My parents kept some of their profits in the bank, donated a portion to the church, and wired another percentage to the relatives in Vietnam, who periodically mailed us thin letters thick with trouble, summed up for me by my mother to the tune of, "No food and no money. No school and no hope." Their relatives' experiences and their own had taught my parents to believe that no country was immune to disaster, and so they secreted another percentage of the profits at home just in case some horrendous calamity wiped out the American banking system. My mother wrapped blocks of $100 bills in plastic and taped them underneath the lid of the toilet tank, buried dog-tag-sized ounces of gold in the rice, and stashed her jade bracelets, 24-karat gold necklaces, and diamond rings in a portable, fireproof safe hidden in the crawlspace underneath the house. To distract thieves, she devised decoys, placing a large glass vase heavy with coins high on a bookshelf by the front door and a pair of gold bracelets on top of her dresser. Her fear of robbery was proven justified last October, when, on an otherwise forgettable Tuesday evening, someone knocked on the door. My father was in the kitchen, having just turned on the stove, and I reached the door a few steps ahead of my mother, already in her nightgown. When I peered through the peephole, I saw a white man who said, "I got mail for you, sir." If he had spoken in Vietnamese or Spanish, I never would have unlocked the door. But because he spoke English, I did. He used his left hand to push his way into the house, a young man in his 20s with feathered hair the color of old straw, long enough to brush the collar of his frayed jeans jacket. Not much taller than my mother, he was slightly built. When he spoke, his voice squeaked like rubber soles on a gym floor. "Get back," he said. His forehead was slick with sweat, and in his right hand was a gun. Even with the passage of decades, I can still see that gun clearly, a black-barreled .22 revolver that he waved before him with a trembling hand as he stepped past the threshold, kicking at the jumble of shoes we kept there and forgetting to close the door. My mother concluded later that he was an amateur, perhaps an addict desperate for money. He pointed the gun past me, at her, and said, "You understand English? Get on the floor!" I backed away, while my mother threw her hands in the air, saying, "Hong, hong, hong!" My father had appeared, halfway between the kitchen and the front door, and the man fixed his aim on my father, saying, "Get down, mister!" My father got onto his knees, raising his hands high. "No shoot," my father said in English, his voice faint. "No shoot, please!" I had never seen my father on his knees outside of church, and I had never seen my mother tremble and shake with fear. Pity overwhelmed me, knowing this was neither the first nor the last time someone would humiliate them like this. As if aware of my thoughts, the man pointed the gun at me wordlessly, and I got down on my knees too. Only my mother did not sink to her knees, her back against the wall and her face, freshly peeled of makeup, very white. Her breasts undulated behind her nightgown like the heads of twin eels as she kept saying, "No!" The man was still aiming his gun at me as he said, "What's the problem, kid?" When my mother screamed, the sound froze everyone except her. She pushed past the man, nudging the gun aside with her hand and bumping him with her shoulder as she ran outside. He stumbled against a bookshelf by the door, knocking over the glass vase full of coins. Falling to the ground, it shattered, spraying pennies, nickels, and dimes all over, the coins mixed with shards of glass. "Jesus Christ!" the man said. When he turned toward the door, my father leapt up and hurled himself against the man's back, shoving him across the threshold and then slamming the door shut. Outside, the gun went off with a short, sharp little pop, the bullet ricocheting off the sidewalk and lodging itself in the wall next to the mailbox, where a policeman would dig it out a few hours later. On Sunday morning before we left for church, my mother used a dab of Brill cream and a black ace comb to slick my hair and part it down the middle. I was horrified at the way I looked, like Alfalfa from Little Rascals, but I didn't protest, just as I hadn't said anything to her after the police brought my mother back home from a neighbor's house.
"I saved our lives, you coward!"
she yelled at my father, who smiled weakly at the police sergeant taking down our report while we sat at the dining table. To me, as she yanked my ear, she said,
"What did I say about opening the door to strangers? How come you never listened to me?"
When the police sergeant asked me to translate, I rubbed my ear and said, "She's just scared, officer." The police never caught the man, and after a while, there was no more reason to mention him. Even so, I thought about him every now and again, especially on Sunday mornings during Mass when I rose from kneeling. It was then that I could not help but remember how I had gotten off my knees, to see my mother dashing by the living room window, barefoot on the sidewalk, before all the people in their cars, hands raised high in the air and wearing only her nightgown in the twilight, shouting something I could not hear. She had saved us. And wasn't salvation always the message from our priest, Father Dint? According to my mother, he was already middle-aged when he led his flock, including my parents, from the north of Vietnam to the south in 1954,
after the communists had kicked out the French and seized the northern half of the country. Fantastically, Father Dent still had more hair than my father, a tuft of white thread that shone under the light illuminating the stained-glass windows. His voice trembled when he said, "In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit," and I could not help but doze in the hard-backed pew while he sermonized, remembering Amy Suchita's nipple and looking forward only to the end of Mass. It was in the crowd jostling for the exit that Mrs. Hua touched my mother's elbow one Sunday, a few weeks after the break-in. "Didn't you enjoy the Father's sermon?" Mrs. Hua said. Her eyes were curiously flat, as if painted onto her face. My mother's back stiffened, and she barely turned her head to say, "I liked it very much." "I haven't heard from you yet about your donation, dear. Next week, perhaps? I'll come by." Mrs. Hua was dressed formally, in an aoyai of midnight velvet embroidered with a golden lotus over the breast. It must have been unbearably hot in summer weather, but no perspiration showed on her temples. "Meanwhile, here's something to read." She produced a sheet of paper from her purse, the same fake alligator skin one with a silver clasp I'd seen last week, and offered it to me. The mimeograph was in Vietnamese, which I could not read, but the blurry photograph said it all. Gaunt men standing at attention in rank and file under fronds of palm trees, wearing exactly the tiger-stripe fatigues I'd imagined. "What a handsome boy." Mrs. Hua's tone was unconvincing. She wore the same white high heels I'd seen before. "And you said your daughter's in college?" "On the East Coast." "Harvard? Yale?" Those were the only two East Coast schools the Vietnamese knew. My mother, who could not pronounce Bryn Mawr, said, "Another one." "What's she studying? Law? Medicine?" My mother looked down in shame when she said, "Philosophy." She had scolded my sister Luan during her Christmas vacation, telling her she was wasting her education. My father had agreed, saying, "Well, everyone needs a doctor or a lawyer, but who needs a philosopher? We can get advice for free from the priest." Mrs. Hua smiled once more and said, "Excellent," after she was gone. I handed the mimeograph to my mother, who shoved it into her purse. In the parking lot, crammed with cars and people, my mother pinched my father and said, "I'm following Mrs. Hua. You and Lang run to the market by yourselves for a few hours." My father grimaced and rubbed his hand over his head. "And what exactly are you planning to do?" "She knows where we work. I'll bet she knows where we live. It's only fair I know the same things, isn't it?" "Okay," my father sighed. "Let's go, son."
"I want to go with Ma."
"You too?" my father muttered. I was curious about Mrs. Hua, and helping my mother was an excuse not to spend my morning at the New Saigon. My mother and I followed her in our Oldsmobile, heading south. Mrs. Hua drove a small Datsun sedan the color of an egg yolk, peppered with flakes of rust. Superimposed upon the Datsun was the Virgin Mary, her image reflected in the windshield from her picture on the dash, as dim as our handful of fading color photos from Vietnam. My favorite featured a smiling young couple sitting on a grassy slope in front of a pink country church. Ba in his sunglasses as he embraced Ma, who wore a peach aoyai over silk cream pants, her abundant hair whipped into a bouffon. "Nansu," my mother said, turning left on the Story Road. Thinking she wanted a translation into English, I said, "A nickel? 5 cents is my profit on a can of soup." As my mother drove, she kept her foot on the brake, not the accelerator. My head bounced back and forth on the headrest like a ball tethered to a paddle. 10 cents for a pound of pork, 25 cents for 10 pounds of rice. That woman wants $500 from me, but you see how we fight for each penny? "Uh-huh," I said, beads of sweat trickling down my armpit. Looking back so many decades later, I wonder if she was exaggerating. Or if I am now, my memory attempting to approximate what our lives felt like. But I'm certain that when I rolled down the window and flung out my hand to surf the breeze, my mother said, "A bus might come along and rip your arm off." I pulled my arm back in and sighed. I yearned for the woman she once was in that old photograph, when my sister and I were not yet born and the war was nowhere to be seen, when my mother and father owned the future. Sometimes I tried to imagine what she looked like when she was even younger, at 9, and I could not. Without a photo,
My mother, as a little girl, no longer existed anywhere, perhaps not even in her own mind. More than all those people starved by famine, it was the thought of my mother not remembering what she looked like as a little girl that saddened me. Mrs. Wyeth turned off Story Road onto a side street, a neighborhood of one-story homes with windows too small for the walls. Well-worn Ford pickups and Chrysler lowriders with chrome rims were parked on the lawns. The front yard of Mrs. Hua's house was paved over, and her yellow Datsun joined a white Toyota Corolla with a crushed bumper and a green Honda Civic missing a hubcap. After Mrs. Hua walked inside, my mother cruised forward to inspect the house, painted with a newish coat of cheap, bright turquoise. The garage transformed into a storefront with sliding glass doors and a red neon sign that said, "Nyamai." The blinds on the tailor shop's windows and the curtains of the living room were drawn, showing their white backs. The man who had invaded our house must have followed us home in the same way, but my mother did not seem to recognize this. Instead, her voice was full of satisfaction when she spoke. "Now," she said, easing her foot off the brake, "we know where she lives." When Mrs. Hua came to the New Saigon on Wednesday afternoon of the following week, I was in the wooden loft my father had hammered together above the kitchenware at the rear of the store. We stored enough long-grain rice in the loft to feed a village, stacked nearly to the ceiling in burlap sacks of 10, 25, and 50 pounds. Oh, the clean carpet scent of jasmine rice permeated the air as I sat astride a dike of rice sacks, reading about reconstruction. I had reached the part about the scalawags and carpetbaggers who had come from the north to help rebuild, or perhaps swindle, the south, when I saw Mrs. Hua at the doorway, wearing the white outfit from her first visit. By the way, my mother gripped the sides of the cash register as if it were a canoe rocking in the waves while Mrs. Wyatt talked to her, I knew there would be trouble. I climbed down the ladder, made my way past aisles stocked with condensed milk and cellophane noodles, shrimp chips and dried cuttlefish, lychees and green mangoes, ducking my head to avoid the yellow strips of sticky fly paper dangling from the ceiling, and reached the front of the store as my mother was saying, "I'm not giving you any money." A crack showed in her foundation, a line creasing her cheek from nose to jawbone. "I work hard for my money. What do you do? You're nothing but a thief and an extortionist, making people think they can still fight this war." I stood behind a row of customers, one of them reading the same mimeograph Mrs. Hua gave me in church. Mrs. Hua's face had turned as white as her outfit, and red lipstick smeared her ochre teeth, bared in fury. She glared at the customers and said, "You heard her, didn't you? She doesn't support the cause. If she's not a communist, she's just as bad as a communist. If you shop here, you're helping communists." Mrs. Hua slammed a stack of mimeographs on the counter by the register, and with that, she left. My mother stared at my father at the register across from her, and neither said a word as the Datsun sputtered into life outside. The customers in front of me shifted uneasily, each one telling their friends, who in turn would tell their friends, who then would tell more people, until everyone in the community knew. My mother turned to the customers with her face as carefully composed as the letters she sent to her relatives, showing no signs of worry, and said, "Who's next?" Throughout the rest of the day, my mother made no mention of Mrs. Hua, and I thought that she would simply ignore her, hoping she would not return. But the moment we got in the car, my mother began talking about her counterattack, and I realized that she had been simmering for hours, keeping quiet for the sake of the customers. My mother would go to Mrs. Hua's and demand an apology, for her accusation could cost my mother her reputation and her business, given the depth of anti-communist fervor in our Vietnamese community. My mother would call Mrs. Hua a disgrace and slap her if she refused. My mother would point out the hopelessness and self-delusion of Mrs. Hua's cause, reducing her to tears with logic. As my mother rehearsed her plans, my father said nothing, and neither did I. We knew better than to oppose her, and when we reached our house, he went wordlessly inside to start dinner, as instructed. My mother drove on to Mrs. Hua's, taking me with her because, she said, "That woman won't do anything crazy with you there. It was 8:30 when my mother parked the car in Mrs. Hua's driveway, behind the Datsun. Mrs. Hua answered the door wearing an orange tank top and a pair of shorts in a purple floral print. Her hair was pinned back in a bun, and her face, bereft of mascara, lipstick, or foundation, belonged to a woman years older, creviced, pitted, cracked. Her small breasts were no bigger than those of Emmy Sachita's, and a map of varicose veins on her skinny thighs and shins led south to gnarled toes, the yellowing nails spotted with red dabs of chipped polish.
"What are you doing here?" Mrs. Hua said.
"I want to speak to you," my mother said. "Aren't you going to invite us in?" Mrs. Hua hesitated, and then stepped back begrudgingly. We took off our shoes and picked our way past the loafers, sneakers, pumps, and flip-flops jammed around the door. Racks on wheels, crammed with hangers for girls' clothes, hid the window, while a pair of bunk beds ran along two walls of the living room. In the center was a long folding table, stacked with notebooks and textbooks. "We're having dinner," Mrs. Hua said. Other voices rang from the dining room. An aerosol of grease clung to the air along with a warm, wet sock odor of cooked rice. "Have you eaten yet?"
"Yes."
If my mother was surprised at Mrs. Hua's politeness, she didn't show it. "I'd like to talk. In private." Mrs. Hua shrugged and led us past the dining room. At the packed table sat 8 or 9 people with heads turned our way. Little girls with bowl cuts, a quartet of grandparents, and a man and woman around my mother's age, the shadows under their eyes so pronounced they looked as if someone had punched them again and again. Just as crowded was Mrs. Hua's bedroom, the first one down the hall. An industrial steel-framed table, a sewing machine fastened to it, dominated the middle of the room, while the velvet aoyai and the white jacket and pants hung from the bunk bed blocking the window. Mrs. Hua sat on the only chair, behind the sewing machine, and said, "What do you want?" My mother glanced at the closet, doors removed to reveal hand-built pine shelves stacked with bolts of silk and cotton. One of the two clothing racks behind Mrs. Hua was hung with everyday clothing, women's slacks and blouses, men's suits and dress shirts, while the other was hung with uniforms, olive-green fatigues, and camouflage outfits patterned with blotches of brown, black, and green in varying shades, the same kind issued to the Marines who had liberated Grenada not long ago. My mother said, "You tailor uniforms for the soldiers?" "American sizes are too large for Vietnamese men, and the proportions aren't right. Plus, the men want their names sewn on in their ranks and units." Mrs. Hua reached under the sewing table and lifted a cardboard box, and when we leaned over the table to peek inside, we saw plastic sandwich bags filled with chevrons and the colorful badges of Vietnamese units. "Some of these uniforms are for the guerrilla army in Thailand, but others are for our men here." I wondered if she meant the rumored secret front, or the men my father's age and younger that I saw at debt festivals, veterans of the vanquished South Vietnamese army who welcomed the new year by wearing military uniforms and checking tickets at the fairgrounds where the festivals happened. "Your husband's a soldier?" my mother said. "He's a commando. The CIA parachuted him into the North in 1963. I haven't heard from him since." Mrs. Hua spoke without any change in inflection, clutching the box to her chest. "The Americans sent my younger son's division to Laos in 1972. He never returned. As for my eldest son, he was in the army too. The communists killed him. I buried him in Bien Hoa in 1969. My daughter wrote to tell me the communists scratched the eyes out of the picture on his grave." My mother was silent, fingering a tiger-striped camouflage jacket hanging from the rack. At last, she said, "I'm sorry to hear about your husband and your sons."
"Sorry for what?"
Mrs. Hua's voice was shrill.
"Whoever said my husband was dead? No one saw him die. No one saw my youngest son die either. They're alive, and no one like you is going to tell me otherwise."
I studied the patterns in the beige carpet, shapes of a frog in a tree, trapped there along with odors of garlic and sesame, sweat and moisturizer. My mother broke the silence by opening her purse and digging inside. From the crumpling of paper, I knew she was opening the envelope with the day's cash. She extracted $200 bills and laid them on the sewing table in front of Mrs. Hua, smoothing the face of Benjamin Franklin on each bill,
the same way she ran her palm over my hair before entering church. "That's it," my mother said. "That's all I have." I calculated the cans of soup, the pounds of rice, and the hours of standing on her feet that made those $200 possible, and I was astonished that my mother had surrendered the money. When Mrs. Weil looked at the cash, I thought she might demand the $500 she'd asked for, but she swept up the bills, folded them, and dropped them into the box on her lap. As she and my mother stared at each other after that, I thought about how years ago my mother had bribed a general's wife with an ounce of gold, buying my father's freedom from the draft. My mother had mentioned the incident one night to my father as they inspected another ounce they had just purchased, and he, glancing at me, had said, "Let's not talk about that." They would file this incident with Mrs. Hua under the same category of things better left unspoken. "We'll see ourselves out," my mother said. "You see how the communists weren't satisfied with killing my son once?" Mrs. Hua aimed her gaze at me.